Turn with me, please, to the 12th chapter of the book of Romans. Romans chapter 12. And we'll be reading from verse 1. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now we'd be looking at verses following that, but for the moment, that reading will do us. This has always been a very important verse, or these verses have been very important in my own life. I believe they lie at the very heart, or root, whichever picture language you want to use, of the Christian life. The book of Romans, of course, begins with God's dealing with sin, or at least with sin in man. The next section deals with salvation. The next section deals with sovereignty, and the next section deals, as here, with consecration. Somehow or other, when we think of consecration, we think of some airy-fairy feeling, you know, I'm a very consecrated person, or he's a very consecrated person. If I read this chapter aright, and I'm sure you will agree with me, it's an extremely practical thing. It's not for the upper 10%. It's not for missionaries or preachers or special people. It's for all believers. He is following the experience of the person from sin through salvation, sanctification, and sovereignty, then service, and dedication and devotion to that service. Paul uses very pleading language here, I beseech you. This indicates that this passage is extremely important. It indicates that it was very near to the heart of the Apostle Paul. He uses it fairly frequently in his letters, though this is not so much a personal letter as a kind of a treatise. But you will notice that this follows on salvation. You read the letter for yourselves, and I'm sure you have done hundreds of times. If you haven't, you certainly should. And as I've already said, beginning with sin, salvation, sanctification, chapter 6, how shall we that are dead or have died unto sin live any longer therein? And then, after the chapters dealing with the sovereignty of God, 9, 10, and 11, we plunge into this, therefore. So if you have been saved, this verse and this whole passage is for you. It divides itself, that is this and the chapters that follow, divide themselves very quickly into sections. I won't touch them now because I don't want to confuse you, and we'll get there. I may have you confused enough by that time. But it's very simple truth. Very surface truth. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. That's the foundation of the appeal, the mercies of God. For if it were not for those mercies, you and I would never have been saved. Indeed, many of us might have been in hell by this time. But in all our need, remember, God gave them over. God gave them up. God gave them over. Lost, totally ruined, defiled, degraded. In the chapter, it speaks of the degradation of the Gentiles in spirit and soul and body. When they knew God, they worshipped him not as God, that's the spirit. They became vain in their imaginations, the desires, the ambitions. In their emotions, they became vile. In their thoughts, polluted, And then, of course, they marred and destroyed their bodies with doing that which is even a shame to mention in a meeting like this. Spirit and soul and body. And then at the end of that chapter, he gives us a long catalogue of the end results of that. And that divides into the degradation of the spirit and the fruits of it, the degradation of the soul, the degradation of the body. Now salvation has swept in. Redemption. God redeems this polluted individual. Because I would like to make this very practical, very personal rather. God now brings it home on the basis, in the light of this infinite mercy of God that has redeemed, that has saved. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. We sing a lot about redemption. And most of the songs that we have about redemption, the hymns that we have about redemption, are connected with its effects on me. You know, redeemed how I love to proclaim it, God's child and forever I am. But when you turn to Scripture, you will find, I believe, that in the majority, if not in all, of the references to redemption, it's the other way around. It's God finding that which had been lost to him. It's God buying back for his own use that which was no use to him, that which had been polluted and perverted by sin. And so when we come to the closing book of the New Testament, we find these people singing in eternity, and surely they've got it right when they're in the presence of the throne of God in the eternal state, and they're singing what? Thou art worthy, for thou wast slain, and hast redeemed us to God. I believe that the thrust of redemption is not so much what we've been redeemed from as the fact that God has bought us. God has purchased us. For the original word simply means to be bought or to be bought back. And so, I have been bought, I have been purchased. I have been bought with precious blood. And in light of that, God expects me to give him what he has paid for. And if I am not giving him what he paid for, then I'm afraid I'm on the wrong track as a believer. If you buy something, you expect to get value for your money, don't you? If you expect something and you are disappointed in it, you buy a car and it turns out to be what's commonly and in slang language known as a lemon, because you gave money for it and you're deeply disappointed in it. I wonder how God feels about having redeemed us. And so often he's not getting what he paid for. Now I'm not throwing this at you as if I were perfect in all of this. God knows my heart. God knows my life. And I've got at least enough sense not to say that kind of thing or even to think it. For every word that I am saying to you has come to me first and has hurt me and has spoken to me. And I have to ask myself, is he getting in my life what he paid for? Because I have been bought. Listen to this word. Ye are not your own. Ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your bodies and in your spirits, which are God's. You're not your own. God now holds sovereign rights over you. Creatorial rights, for he is your creator, but he lost you, of course. Then by redemptive right, he has purchased you for himself. Now the first place we seem to run into this word in the Old Testament gives us something of the meaning of it. God refers again and again of having redeemed his people Israel from Egypt. They were his redeemed people. And he sent his message to Pharaoh. And it was not, let my people go because they're having a hard time. It's not, let my people go because they're really suffering horribly and you're going to pay for it. Both of which facts were true. But what did he say? Let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. They're mine. And he says in the very next chapter that all those who are covered by the blood and saved from death in Egypt, the firstborn is mine. See, those are the ones that were going to die. The firstborn. They were marked for death. But the blood covered them. And now, the very next step, chapter 13 of the book of Exodus, read it. All the firstborn are mine. All those who would have been slain, all of those who were covered by the blood, they are mine in a very special way. Now, he took the Levites in their place, but they all had to pay a silver coin, and that was in token of the fact that they had been redeemed. Not redeemed to have a good time in Egypt. Not redeemed to be taken to some wayside place to set up a whole new community. Oh, no. Let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. And the word serve there is to serve religiously. It's a servant priestly service. And as soon as they got out, he said, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. They're my people. Have you a deep consciousness, my dear brother or sister, of having been bought by God for his exclusive use? Would it be possible that you are using for your own uses that which belongs to him? If you are, I think you'd better get down on your knees and have some dealings with God, because you're violating a very basic principle. If I were to sell a car to someone, he paid me for it. I gave him the papers. I gave him the keys. But it so happened that I kept a set of keys. And he was very pleased with the car. But one day, it enters my mind, as I pass by his driveway, and the car's there and he's not around. And I happen to have the extra keys that I didn't give him. So I decided to take the car, which he bought. He bought it. I surrendered it to him. And it's so easy to sing, isn't it? I surrender all. But he's the owner. He's paid the money. He has the papers. Deeds are everything signed and legalized. But I think I'll go for a little trot around the block. So I take his car out and I go for a drive in it. I don't scratch it. I don't bang it up. I don't waste it in any particular way. Bring it back and plant it. What would you say about me if you were the person who had bought the car? I rather suggest that you would call me nothing better than a common cheat. And you would be dead right. For you had paid and taken possession of something, and now, the person who once had right of control over it comes. He has received the price. He has received the money. Now he's running around using the car for a little jaunt. And God looks down at me, sees me using my body and using my whole personality for anything short of his glory, and he must be disappointed. When I was a boy, I remember a tract, a very simple tract, a rather emotional thing, but it got a lesson across to me. I heard gospel preachers using it, but little boy who whittled a little boat himself with his little knife, and he carved this little boat, he'd get pleasure in it, and got a little mast on it and sails. He had a little bit of string and he got it out on a pond or in the sea or somewhere, and it sailed back and forth, and then the wind caught it and away it went and he lost it. And he longed and yearned after this little boat of his. And then one day, going down the street, he saw it in the window of one of those junk shops, a pawn shop. You wouldn't know what pawn shops are today, I suppose, but I know very well. And he saw his own little boat in the window, and his heart jumped. He went in and he said to the man, "Mister, that's my boat." And the man said, "I'm sorry, son, it's my boat because I bought it." "Well," he said, "it's mine. I'd like to have it back." And the man said, "Well, you're going to have to pay for it." The little laddie didn't have much money, but he scurried around and he got some, and he brought it, and whether it was the right sum or not, I don't know. But the man, in any case, took the money, gave it to him. Now, the point of the story is that the little fellow outside, he looked at his little boat and he hugged it, as only a little boy can do, with a precious boat like this. And he said, "Little boat, I made you, I loved you, I lost you, I found you, I bought you back, and now you're mine." That's what redemption is all about. The sheep didn't rejoice when the shepherd found it. The shepherd rejoiced he'd lost his sheep. The coin didn't rejoice. It was the woman who had lost the coin. Those passages have all got to do with the fact that God lost something, and Christ bought it back for him. It's not a question of the prodigal son setting up the feast and rejoicing. The father rejoices over one who was dead to him, and now he's back. The whole series of parables, it's really one parable, I believe, from three angles. And it's always the finder of the lost thing that's rejoicing. God rejoiced over me the night I accepted his offer of salvation. Now, I started singing, "Redeemed, how I love to proclaim it." But you know, it took me a wee while to learn from the word that God had bought me spirit and soul and body, that I was no longer my own. For my Bible says, "If thou shalt confess with thy mouth Jesus as Lord," which is the way it should read, "believing in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved." Confessing him as Lord, the word kurios for Lord means owner. It means the one who has power of disposal of the article, the person, the thing. It's his. He can do what he likes with it. He sends it, he calls it, he controls it. You are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Now, he says, surrender to God that which he has bought. So this is all of that. Present your bodies. In the Old Testament, men presented sacrifices. And it's rather a pity that we have confused the presentation of the offering and the sacrificing of the offering. And this, the offering, was the one when he brought it to God. And he offered it. If it were accepted, then it was slain. But the two are quite distinct. Now, this is this offering process. It's bringing ourselves before him and saying, "Lord, I acknowledge that I am yours by right of creation, lost to you through sin, but I am now yours by right of redemption. And I want to live as yours." Is this true? I mean, experientially? Is this the way we look at our lives? Or did he do everything and I'm so happy, here's the reason why, jiggly jig. This kind of nonsense is deceptive to the people of God. This is serious business. God lost, God bought, God paid for. Now, he says, everyone that's under the blood is mine. We're back to Exodus 13, but here it's so very, very carefully spelled out. Present your bodies. A living sacrifice. The presentation is here, and the sacrifice is here. Except that here there is no killing. Presented to God. Let me ask you, have you ever in any meaningful way accepted this truth? Have you ever, my fellow Christian, for it's only Christians can talk about this thing, of course. Have you ever in any meaningful way in your life got down before God and said, I recognize that you have purchased me, and therefore I am offering, surrendering myself, my body, to you, to be disposed of as you wish, when you wish, where you wish. Now look at what follows. That which was offered to God must be holy. God's not interested in dirty rags. Anything that's offered to God has to be clean, or he would reject it. Acceptable unto God. Acceptable. Your reasonable service. Your intelligent service. This is, as I mentioned in the very first words that I spoke this evening, this is not for the upper 10% or 5% or 2%. This is for every believer. It's the intelligent, reasonable thing that they can do. It's not an extra. It's the absolute. It's the very foundation of all Christian living. And he said, why callest thou me Lord, Lord, and doest not thus not the things that I say unto you? Lord means supreme owner. I am thine, O Lord. I have heard thy voice. So easy to sing these things, isn't it? Now, he says, this is just your intelligent service. The next step from that is, and be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your minds. Now the word conformed means like squeezing something into a mold from the outside, making it correspond to an outside pressure. That's what the world is trying to do to you and to me. It is trying to squeeze us into its mold. And so we say quite blithely, well, you know, all the other children at school do it. Maybe that's the best reason in the world why you shouldn't be doing it, because the other children at school are not the Lord's. They haven't been bought, they haven't been purchased, and you have. And if you are young, and you are a Christian, and you're at school, it's not a question of whether or not we can ask you to be different. If you are God, you are different. And you're supposed to live differently, act differently. And he turns then to us, those of us who are older, those of us who have accepted him, and in the early days, I trust, of our Christian experience, he said, don't let that world squeeze you into its mold. Don't let it do it to you. Well, all the other businessmen do it. You know, it's the common practice. All the other lawyers do it. All the other doctors do it. All the other farmers do it. All the other people do it. And so we get into that frame of mind where we want the same kinds of things that the worldly people around us have and do because we think the way they think. I think the in phrase for it is upward mobility. Upward mobility. Getting on in the world. I sometimes wonder what the Lord thinks about our getting on in the world. I wonder if he looks and says, my dear child, how do you manage to get on so well in the world? They murdered me. They spat in my face. They beat me over the face until I didn't look human anymore. And then they nailed me to a cross. And you are my witness. How do you get on so well? Now I leave you to answer that one because I don't know. Be not conformed. Don't let the world press you into its mold. Oh, I know there are pressures these days. I know there are pressures. God expects us to be a different people because we are his people. Be not conformed, but be ye transformed. Now they're not the same word. They're not the same word, of course, the form part of it is, But as I've said, comfort means squeezed from the outside into the image of something else, whereas transformed is the word from which we get our word metamorphosis. And that's the word, I'm sure, as you know, because you've all got a lot more schooling than I've ever had, that means changed from the inside. A grubby, hairy, ugly-looking little caterpillar. And after a long process, one day it breaks through its cocoon and it spreads its wings and it changes into a butterfly. Now, some scientists didn't do that. It changed from a grub into a butterfly because there was something inside it. It was set up to do that. And it became what its creator intended it to be, a butterfly. But that process from grub to butterfly is metamorphosis. Now, he says, I have bought you. I have recreated you. I have put within you my spirit. Do not let that world squeeze you into its image, but allow that new life that is in you, fed and cared for and tenderly treated in the presence of God in prayer and reading his word, that whole life of yours should be transformed. Now we get that word again, and the thought again, in those words which say, lift. We all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory. Now, the verb changed is our word here. Changed, and the form of the verb is that it's a progressive thing. We are progressively changed into the same image. What image? The image of Christ, not the image of the world. How do we do it? Transformed by being totally occupied with God's glorious Christ. And as we gaze on him, we're changed. From one glory to another, progressively, and the tense of the verb is a continuous, progressive thing. It's a process. And as we gaze on him, but alas, 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 we don't gaze on him nearly enough. We sing it, of course, gazing on thee, Lord, in glory, while our hearts before thee bow. Transformed. Moses was transformed. Even outwardly, his face shone. How did it happen? He spent over a month up on top of the hill, the mountain, with God. And he came down resplendent with the glory of God, whose glory had not yet been seen, because it really was seen as fullness from the tabernacle was built. Don't allow the world, I beg of you, I beseech of you, he says, don't allow the world to squeeze you into its image, but allow the power of God to transform you into his image. We're dealing with very serious business here, aren't we? Transformed. Aha. By the renewing of your mind. Now, he's not talking about a brain transplant. He's talking about a total change of thinking, a change in our whole thought processes, a change in our approach to things, a change in what we think about, about things. Paul says, I thought I did God service. That is, while he was persecuting and even murdering some of God's children. He said, I thought I did God's service. See how perverted his mind was? He said, I gloried in my circumcision. I gloried in the fact that I belonged to the chosen nation. I am my forefathers. I was royal blood. I was Saul after the first king of Israel. And I gloried in all of this. Oh, he said, later on, I saw that sevenfold glory like a heap of dung. That's a plain enough word, isn't it? And he said, I gave it up not Well, you know, you have to give up a lot of things. Isn't it terrible the things we have to give up to be Christians, you know, to please the brethren and so on? He said it became utterly repulsive to me. Why? Because his thinking had been changed. That's why. For as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And if you think long enough about something, that's what you'll be talking about. That's what you'll be going in for. A very dear friend of mine, an African brother, for whose entire wardrobe you wouldn't have given 50 cents. Indeed, you wouldn't have touched it except probably on the end of a stick. But he was a real man of God. I was out with him once in the villages, and he was urging the Christians to remember their hearts, keep their insides right. And he said, you know, your tongue, now listen very carefully, this is a piece of Chokwe philosophy. He said, your tongue is just the tail end of your heart sticking out of your mouth. And whatever you are constantly talking about, that's what you're thinking about. If you have your mind set on things, that will, you know, that's your conversation. Did you hear about it? What about it? Look up the magazine. Look up the papers. No. Paul says, all of that I swept away as unworthy trash. Why? His mind was changed, that's why. He thought differently. He now saw that what he thought was service to God brought him into a head-on collision with God. I thought I did God service. Now I know that I was sinning. And so, the renewing of your mind. Oh, we need our whole thinking changed. That's what we need. Where will we ever find it changed? Here, in this book. That's why. Feeding on this book, we see the mind of God revealed, we see the heart of God revealed, we see the glory of Christ revealed, and as we read it and live in it, we too are transformed, for we see him. Remember Stephen? A group of malicious, evil men snarling, and he knew they were going to crush his body to a pulp with great boulders, for the Jews didn't throw little stones at people to kill them. They put them in a hole and they threw boulders on them and crushed them to pieces. It was a dreadful death. And he saw these murderous faces glowering at him. And he said, I see Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And what did they see? They saw, as it were, the face of an angel. He was transformed. He didn't become like them. You see, he was looking at something they couldn't look at. And his face was like a mirror tilted. They could look in the mirror, which was his face, and they could realize what he was looking at. And they looked on something which they thought was like the face of an angel. The transforming power of Christ. The renewing of your mind. And what's the end result of that? That you may prove, and this means that you may prove experientially, what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God? Now, the three words refer to the same thing. They all refer to the Word of God. To the will of God. Good means that it is essentially perfect. It is essentially good in quality, in character, the will of God. In other words, you may look at the will of God and say, well, that's very hard. And I think that I would be just as good a Christian if I took some other path. But of course, you're all wrong. You're all wrong, because God's will is always essentially good for you, as well as for him. But then he says, it's not only good, it's perfect. And that means there isn't anything better, no matter what you may think. I heard a woman, she said it to me, a sister in an assembly I was in during the war in Quebec, and a girl there, a lovely Christian girl, was going, an unconverted boy or man, I can't remember what. And I said to the pure Christian woman, I said, isn't it terrible that this lovely girl is going to waste herself because she's going to run into trouble? marrying this unconverted man. And she said, well, I suppose, but at least, she won't be a lonely old woman sitting in a corner doing her knitting. She wasn't. She was a distressed and ruined girl and lived to prove it. God's will is always best. It is essentially good in character, and you will search the universe and you will never be able to say to God, but I've got a better idea. He said, no, my way is perfect. There isn't anything better. And then he said, acceptable. This is where the crunch comes in. Acceptable. It's not always easy. I might say, for example, that I did not want to go to Africa. I had other plans. And I had to struggle and wrestle with this. And there came a time when I just had to say, Lord, whatever your will is, has to be my will. There isn't anything better than your will. Whatever I would choose would have to be, in its very nature, inferior to what you purposed for me, whatever may lie ahead of me. And of course, what lies ahead of me? The future is in God's hand. God holds the key of all unknown, and I am blessed. And so, it is essentially good. There is nothing better. And it is acceptable. Oh, what a moment that is in the life of a Christian. Early on in that Christian experience, when again and again, and it's not just a once for all thing, this, it keeps going on and on and on. Every turn of the road, sweet will of God still hold me.